Chapter 11. The Hollow Shepherd. Sidney Grice palmed the spoon from his saucer as if trying to pilfer it.
"Freddie and I were bored," Lucy began.
"Why?" he demanded, and Lucy shifted uncomfortably.
"The life of a modern girl in London out of season is tedious in the extreme. There are no balls, nothing new at the theatre, no dinner parties, no—"
"I know what tedious means." Mr. G. chipped at his tea, as if the meniscus were a thin sheet of ice. "I have to converse with Miss Middleton daily, and I once sat through an entire production of Hamlet without being allowed to interrupt it once. This tea, incidentally, is horrid. And so what remedy was proposed for this insipid languorousness, and by whom?"
"Freddie had been to a few opium dens in the past. They sounded terrifically racy, and she had never come to any harm in them, except once when she had her purse taken on the way home. And so we decided to give it a go."
Mr. G. took his spoon by the tip of the handle between his thumb and fourth finger and stirred his black tea with great attention.
"So it was Freddie's idea," I clarified. "Well, yes, I suppose it was."
Lucy stretched her arms as if about to dive off rocks into the sea.
"But I did not need persuading."
"You went by cab?" I asked, trying to ignore my guardian's sigh at my use of another leading question. He shook the spoon dry and hid it under the corner of a napkin.
"It was the coachman's night off," Lucy confirmed. "And besides, we did not want the servants to know what we were up to. It sets such a bad example."
"Who instructed the driver, and what instructions was he given?" Sidney Grice fingered the jackal ring on his watch chain.
"I said, 'Limehouse, if you please,' but—"
Lucy let her arms drop heavily into her lap.
"He did not please in the least until Freddie offered to double his fare. And then he seemed quite pleased after all."
"How did you decide which opium house to go to?" I asked.
"Luck, really."
Lucy pulled a wry face.
"Rotten luck, as it turned out. The cabbie was getting nervous. Beggars were crowding round us, and children were climbing on the back for free rides. People were shouting coarse remarks, and somebody threw dung at his horse. We came to the top of an alley that looked quite well lit with lanterns in some of the windows or over the lintels, so we told him to stop there. We got out, but nothing would persuade him to wait or come back for us."
"From which side did you disembark?" my guardian asked.
"The left."
Lucy touched her broken cheekbone gingerly.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because it is immaterial." Lucy tilted her head to the right.
"I am confused."
Mr. G. mirrored her action. "People inventing stories do not expect to be cross-examined on irrelevancies." He straightened his neck, and she followed suit. "It flusters them to be diverted from their rehearsed versions, with details they are unlikely to have considered. In many cases, their whole account will instantly unravel, and even the best of actors tend to direct their eyes to the left, whilst their brains sift through plausible responses." Mr. G. drew a squiggle. He and she blinked simultaneously.
"So you know I am telling the truth?"
Lucy curled a tress around her finger, but he did not. "It is not an infallible test." Sidney Grice tapped a line of dots down the page. "But in future, if you decide to create a fiction without notice in my presence, you will fix your eyes in an unnatural manner." He joined the dots in a sweeping curve. "Beside which there are 7 other signs which I stalk." He underlined the squiggle. "Continue."
"We made our way down the alley. A group of ragged children followed us, but Freddie got rid of them by tossing a handful of coppers over their heads into the court where we had been dropped off. They all chased after them, and we ducked through one of the lit doorways."
"Who chose which one?" I asked, and Lucy hesitated, nonplussed.
"We saw a name on the wall written in Chinese, and under it in English, The Golden Dragon, and we just dashed in.
What was the place like? I asked.
Seedy,
Lucy said.
Gloomily lit and frosty. There was an outer room with a tall Chinaman sitting on a stool. Freddy took charge. She asked if they sold poppy dreams, and he nodded and smiled. He was very polite and formal. She asked how much, and we gave him a guinea each.
Oh, I would have only paid 10 shillings, I said. Clearly you look more prosperous than I. My guardian's lips worked silently.
Or more stupid, she said. A boy showed us through.
Describe, Mr. G commanded.
The boy?
I am not interested in your grandmother's wart at present, he rejoined, and she stifled a giggle. It is no laughing matter, he reproved, and Lucy's face stiffened.
I do not need you to tell me that, Mr. Grice.
She licked her lips again.
The boy was about 10 years old, I would say, Chinese in his features, dress, and accent.
What did he say? I asked, and she put her hands together.
Very good evening, madams. Please come this way. Ah, so you like it?
Oh, dear,
Mr. G butted in. I was unprepared to hold an audition for an amateur production of one of Miss Middleton's melodramas. I thought this rather unfair, as I had written my plays when I was a child, and he had come across the jottings during a search of my room. He clipped his pince-nez on the tip of his long, thin nose to scrutinize her over the gold wire frame.
Where did he take you?
Through a secret door, she said, though not very secret. The wall was covered with bamboo screens, and they just slid one aside. It led down some wooden steps into a cellar.
Lit how?
He circled a symbol 4 times.
By oil lamps hanging from the ceiling.
Were you not scared? I asked.
Terrified, she admitted. But I was dashed if I was going to show it.
What was the room like? I asked.
Save that for your memoirs, Mr. G snapped. Let us cut to the chase. Presumably, correct me if I am uncharacteristically wrong, it was decorated in lurid pictures of an indecent nature and had couches round the walls. How many?
4.
Occupied?
He scribbled, dashed, and fenced it into an ellipse.
Only one of them, by a man.
Describe.
He pointed at her with the blunt end of his modern mechanical pencil.
It was too dark to see him really well. Average height and solidly built.
Could you see what he was wearing? I asked, and my guardian indicated towards me proudly.
See how well I am training her. A relevant question at last.
Lucy shook her head in mild amusement.
No, but he was well-dressed.
How could you tell? I smoothed down my dress and wondered if Mr. G's pernickettiness was contagious.
I heard his boots creak, Lucy explained. So they must have been new. Old leather does not make a noise like that.
Wunderbar!
Mr. G clapped his hands together.
What an excellent client you are evolving into.
His hands flew apart as if they repelled each other magnetically.
With your exemplary perspicacity, we have travelled 1/34th of our journey towards the resolution of this matter.
Lucy wrinkled her brow.
Because I noticed that a man had new boots.
Precisely so.
Sidney Grice's hands seemed drawn by the same power towards his knees, but he resisted the force and left them hovering a few inches above his immaculately pressed lilac trousers.
The Putney Pickle Purifier might never have been caught had he parted his hair less carefully.
Lucy tossed me a bemused glance, but it was not a case with which I was familiar. Mr. G permitted his hands to rest on his knees, gradually and one at a time. I struggled to get back on track. Who showed you how to smoke opium?
Freddy.
How many pipes did you have?
I think I only had one. I was unused to it, and the effects were very powerful. And the next thing I knew...
Lucy made a fist and crammed it between her teeth. Sidney Grice shook his watch and put it to his ear.
Time has not stopped. Why have you?
Lucy fought back the tears. I rounded on him. Can you not see how painful this is for her?
Of course I can, he said, and I have reconsidered my position.
He slipped his watch away.
I shall have a Garibaldi after all.
Sidney Grice reached over and helped himself.
I hope I shall not regret it.
He bit a crescent out of one of the long sides and chewed, meditatively.
I am happy to say that my hopes were dashed.
Happy? I echoed automatically.
It will be a sad day that my hopes are satisfied by an adhesive confection.
Why are you rambling about Garibaldi's when Miss Bocking is on the verge of a nervous collapse? I demanded.
Lucy took her hand from her mouth and said, It is all right, March. He has brought me back from that brink.
Mr. G. put the part-eaten biscuit on an empty plate with such care. It might have been a unique piece of exquisite porcelain.
I have already remarked that our client is that rarest of creatures, an intelligent woman.
He pushed the lead back into his pencil.
I shall return tomorrow, Miss Bocking, at 11:19 in the morning, since you have no tea fit to brew after that hour.
Mr. G. snapped his notebook shut and put it into his satchel. Lucy opened her mouth and closed it before gasping,
But we have not finished.
What on earth gave you that idea?
He sprang to his feet.
You have become attached to a botanical specimen, Miss Middleton.
I rose and saw that the broken stem had caught by one of its hooked leaves to the side of my dress.
We can see ourselves out.
He pressed the bell button.
But we shall not.
I looked at Lucy, shocked and desolate in her chair.
I am sorry about this.
I detached the stalk and placed it guiltily on the table. But we will bring the man who hurt you to justice.
Just catch him.
Lucy looked up at me, a new fire in her eyes.
You can leave the justice to me.
Lucy's head dropped and she did not react as I touched her arm in farewell and, when I looked out, my guardian was creeping across the drawing-room round a hollow shepherd that lay in three segments and 100 shards. He put a finger to his lips and signalled at me to stand back, wrenched the china handle round and threw open the door.
By Jupiter!
He cried as it crashed against the display cabinet, upsetting a powder-blue shepherdess onto her back.
Has that woman no shame?
He exuded indignation.
She is not even eavesdropping. No need to throw 'em, 'cause I'm here to sew 'em,
the cobbler chanted from across the road as the maid showed us out of Amber House. He had hung a sign with a picture of a shoe on the railings and pushed his cart into the bushes overhanging the railings.
A poet laureate in waiting,
Sidney Grice opined, knocking against the sign so it fell, bent, to the ground. He sniffed, then stepped delicately over an earwig before brushing it carefully aside.
I am so very sorry,
he apologized to it.